Welcome, everyone. My name is Alex Lennon. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Washington Quarterly here at CSIS. We'd like to welcome you to a roundtable. This is a series we've started that we try and do either after an article's been published or in some cases before an issue or an article comes out to help an author think through an idea. In this case, we're more than happy to have Mark Kramer in town. This session actually started on a lark about 10 to 12 days ago. I sent Mark an email and say, hey, are you coming through Washington by any chance over the summer? Because we'd love to have a session where you can talk through the findings of your article. And he said, actually, I'll be there in a week. Can you put it together? So that went from there. The turnout, I think, speaks to the quality of Mark's work and to the impact of the findings that he has in his piece. To have about 60 people come out on a short week in the holiday at the beginning of the summer is large for these types of sessions. Please feel free during the discussion to jump up and get additional stuff behind you, either sugar to keep your energy up for the discussion or caffeine for that matter if you need it, which I doubt. I'm going to turn the session over to Mark, who I'm sure all of you know is the director of the Cold War Studies Project at Harvard, and have him talk for about 10 to 15 minutes on the findings of his article, which was published in the last issue, and then we'll turn it over to a discussion session after that. So with Mark, over to you.
Thank you very much, Alex, and thanks especially for arranging this at such short notice. I'd also like to thank everyone who has turned out at such short notice, including the person who actually inspired me to write this in a previous capacity, Celeste Wallander, who is sitting over there, who is now a senior official in the U.S. Defense Department. But this was in her capacity as a private scholar, a longtime friend of mine previously at Harvard and has been in the Washington, D.C. area for a long time. She had been hearing claims about the provision of pledges or commitments by NATO leaders, especially U.S. leaders, to the Soviet Union in 1990 and was skeptical. And she suggested that I take a look at this question. And so I thank her for having inspired me to write it. What I did, and let me comment quickly on Suisse's, I'm not going to speak long here because it would just essentially be to recapitulate the article. And I don't see any need for that, per se. But let me comment on a few points about it. One, on the availability of sources. In thinking about this question about whether, as claimed, the United States or West Germany or Britain provided a concrete assurance, a pledge, or a categorical assurance, as it's been described, and I'll get to a couple of the identities of those who've claimed it. But in thinking about that, what's especially important is to look at the Soviet records to understand how Soviet leaders understood what they were being told. Now, it's also important, though, to look at the English and German records, the English language and German language records, to be able to compare those to the Russian records to see whether the Russian records are reliable or complete. So what I did was, this was a task that until quite recently was impossible. The American records, the West German records are available and were available a while ago, though it were released in stages. So it wasn't until quite recently that you could actually go through them more completely. But most important, again, though, I think, were the Soviet records. The Soviet records were inaccessible until late 2006, when the records from the discussions of these meetings on the Soviet side, the Soviet transcripts, became available. Those were published in abridged form in a very useful book in Russian, and that book is readily available in Moscow. But more importantly, I then went to the archive where these records are stored and looked at the complete set of them there. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds, or actually thousands of pages of negotiation records from all of these different, from all sides, the English, the German, and the Russian. The first thing I found, which was reassuring, is that the transcripts on all sides were very reliable, that they tallied well. There were no significant discrepancies. There were occasional discrepancies of minor wording. But by and large, the transcripts were identical on all sides, especially for the most important conversations. Now, the debate about this issue has focused on a few bilateral negotiations. And that's one point that becomes evident as you explore this question quite quickly, is that this was a process decided predominantly in bilateral talks, not in the multilateral 2+4 negotiations drew a lot of attention, but that's not really where decisions were made. It was bilateral talks between American leaders and Soviet leaders and between West German leaders and Soviet leaders. And that's why I have focused primarily. I did go through all of the multilateral talks as well, but the bilateral talks deserve special scrutiny, and I have looked at those in this article. Let me say that I also have followed up, though, with conversations with some of the participants in this, especially on the Soviet side. I wanted, again, to look at how they understood what they had been told. It's a difficult question to try to explore many years after the fact, because people in thinking back then may look on it through the lens of what they believe now rather than what they believed at the time. But still, the two people that I was especially interested in talking to were Pavel Polashchenko, who was Gorbachev's, you've probably seen him before, he's Gorbachev's interpreter. He is bald, has a mustache, was present at a lot of conversations, an excellent interpreter, I should add. He speaks English flawlessly, even though he's not a native English speaker. And he was present at the discussions between American leaders and Gorbachev. And I also spoke with a couple of the people who had interpreted at the discussions between West German leaders and Gorbachev. Although one of them is dead now, but the other one who's still alive I spoke with. In addition, I spoke with Anatoly Chernyayev, who was Gorbachev's chief foreign policy advisor. I wanted to find out from them what was the specific point at which this assurance or commitment or pledge was provided. Chernyayev and Polashchenko in particular said that they don't recall such a specific pledge or commitment and the like. So that, again, the inability of former officials to identify a point at which such a pledge was provided reinforced my thinking that the transcripts told the story, that's really what's there. In the transcripts you will find of all of these talks, again, thousands of pages of these, you will find that there was extensive discussion about NATO, but it focused only on what the role of NATO would be in Eastern Germany. Initially, Gorbachev had opposed the membership of a united Germany in NATO, and he held out against that until July of 1990. He wanted to see a neutral Germany. Initially, he had proposed, as did a well-known historian at Yale University, to have Germany as both a member of NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Gorbachev abandoned that idea, I think, before that historian did, but it soon, again, became apparent that that sort of solution would be infeasible or impractical. So instead, Gorbachev wanted a neutral Germany outside either alliance, and he stuck to that basic position, really, until July 1990. But because he had already recognized that Germany was going to be reunified, he did concede on that earlier. There really wasn't much the Soviet Union per se could do, whereas it could exert through its troop presence in Eastern Germany and its legal obligations under the settlements after the Second World War. It could forestall or at least make very difficult Germany's integration into NATO. So that was the crux of the issue, really, was not so much unification of Germany, but whether Gorbachev would accept a unified Germany in NATO. So a lot of the discussion focused on what the role of NATO would be in Eastern Germany, and as the concession by Gorbachev on that issue during his talks with Helmut Kohl in Stavropol and Moscow in July 1990 began to coalesce, The discussions focused a good deal on whether NATO troops would be permitted in eastern Germany, how you would try to deal with the continued presence of Soviet and what became Russian forces in eastern Germany as they were being pulled out, because it was quite clear that a withdrawal of Soviet forces would take several years at a minimum. So those issues were discussed at length, but at no point during these negotiations did the issue of the further expansion of NATO, that is, the movement of NATO to include other Warsaw Pact countries or, in the more distant future, the countries that had been components of the Soviet Union, like the Baltic states, did that issue ever come up? It never came up. It was never broached. It wasn't an issue of concern for Soviet leaders at the time. That's not what Gorbachev was focused on. He was quite confident that until well into the spring of 1990, that the Warsaw Pact would continue to exist, albeit primarily as a political organization, not as so much as a military alliance any longer. It was clear that those days were over, but he did have a great deal of confidence it would last. That began to fade, but he also then was confident, as were many Western analysts, who predicted that NATO would soon dissolve because of the disappearance of the threat that it had been set up to counter. So Gorbachev at that point was quite confident that the Warsaw Pact, as it was gradually being abandoned and was formally dissolved in mid-1991, but before that he was confident that the two organizations would cease to exist. Both the Warsaw Pact and NATO would cease to exist. So the question about whether NATO would expand beyond Eastern Germany didn't come up. It simply didn't come up. The issue was never raised. Soviet leaders did not claim at the time that it was raised. They didn't claim they had been offered a pledge or a categorical assurance. So then why have these claims been put forth? From the Russian government, you can understand it. At times, these claims are somewhat vague. In other cases, they are quite specific. There was a recent speech by Vladimir Putin in which he was speaking in Munich, and he said, he referred to assurances our Western partners made, and he says, no one even remembers, I'm quoting now from his speech, no one even remembers them. This was last year. No one even remembers them, but I will allow myself to remind this audience what was said. I would like to quote the speech of NATO General Secretary Mr. Werner, Manfred Werner, who was then Secretary General of NATO, in Brussels on 17 May 1990. He said at the time that, quote, the fact that we are ready not to place a NATO army outside German territory gives the Soviet Union a firm security guarantee. Okay, that if that were an accurate quotation, it would, in fact, be something like a pledge or an assurance. Fortunately, the speech that Werner gave, which he gave in English, is available, and also the Russian translation of that speech are available. The Russian translation is identical to the English. So let me read briefly what Putin claimed that Werner said was, this was from Werner, he's quoting, the fact that we are ready not to place a NATO army outside German territory gives the Soviet Union a firm security guarantee. What Werner actually said, and this again was May 1990 when two Germanys still existed, he said, the fact that we are ready not to place a NATO army outside outside the territory of the current Federal Republic, in other words, Western Germany, gives the Soviet Union firm security guarantees. Moreover, we could conceive of a transitional period during which a reduced number of Soviet forces could remain stationed in the present GDR. So all that Werner was talking about was not stationing troops outside German territory, which gives a misleading impression that he was referring to a future unified Germany. He was just talking about Western Germany and Eastern Germany, issues that had been brought up many times in the past. So even when, on the one instance when a Russian leader has provided what was regarded as a concrete assurance or guarantee, he deliberately, but maybe I should. His aides were incompetent, misquotes what was actually said and misquotes it in a way that really fundamentally changes the meaning of it. There are others, though, on the Western side. In particular, I have been struck that someone whom I respect a great deal, Jack Matlock, who was U.S. ambassador at the time but wasn't present during most of these negotiations, Matlock, who has written two very good books, Autopsy on an Empire and Reagan and Gorbachev, nonetheless claims, and I quote, he says that Gorbachev received, quote, a clear commitment that if Germany united and stayed in NATO, the borders of NATO would not move eastward. And as I say, there is simply, in the negotiating record, there is simply no indication of such a pledge. So, again, if someone can provide solid evidence to me of such a pledge, then I'll be glad to change my mind on this. But until I see solid evidence of what this pledge was and when it was made, I have to say that I simply cannot accept the many claims that are made, either citing inaccurate quotations or just making general statements that such a pledge or commitment was made. In this article, I have tried to look at that specific question. It's not intended to be an assessment of whether NATO enlargement itself was wise. There you can debate. There were clearly many advantages to NATO enlargement, also many disadvantages. It's a valid issue to debate. But on this specific question about whether opposition to NATO enlargement can be founded on the notion that a concrete pledge was provided to the Soviet Union in 1990 during the process of German unification, I think the debate really shouldn't be a debate, because the guarantee or commitment or categorical assurance simply was not there. So with that, I end, and we'll be glad. I hope that there is someone here from the Russian embassy and would welcome comments from that angle as well as others.
With that, for the discussion session, I'm going to ask people just to identify themselves and the organization they're from, except in Dr. Brzezinski's case, who I think most of you know, and let you take the lead.
First of all, congratulations. It's a really important historical piece of work, and you're to be complimented. This is not a challenge. It's literally a question. Is it conceivable that something transpired in 1991 when the Warsaw Pact was being dissolved? There was a session of the Warsaw Pact, and the governments participating were the new governments, but some of them initially, I think for tactical reasons, spoke actually of preserving the Warsaw Pact. That's even true of the most anti-communist of the East European countries, namely Poland. The Polish Prime Minister talked in those terms. Is it conceivable, and this does not invalidate your thesis in any way, because they're not part of NATO, but is it conceivable that in the course of these proceedings, some of them indicated that they will not be joining NATO?
I did look into this question for precisely the reason you mentioned, and thank you very much for raising the question. Is exactly as you say, initially, especially in early 1990, the Polish government, when Helmut Kohl and other German, West German officials, I should say, were ambiguous about the status of Germany, of a united Germany's borders, what they would be as Germany united. The Polish government at that time, which was under Prime Minister Tadeusz Mazowiecki, opposed initially the notion of any sort of movement away from the Warsaw Pact, and actually called, in addition, for Soviet troops to stay in Poland. And that position continued really into the spring of 1990, and it's one of the reasons that Gorbachev was highly confident initially that the Warsaw Pact would survive. Some of the discussions that Gorbachev had with his aides at the time led him to believe that they could exploit the sentiments of some of the East European governments about preserving the Warsaw Pact. But even then, though, there were signs, especially with the early moves by Hungary and Czechoslovakia to seek the withdrawal of Soviet forces, that that probably was not going to be a particularly tenable position. And so for that reason, Gorbachev's confidence, even at that point, seems to have been misplaced. As 1990 moved on, and I emphasize this period here because what was true at one point in 1990 isn't necessarily true at another. As 1990 moved on, there came increased pressure from the East European governments to do something with NATO. But even in the summer of 1990, when Prime Minister Antal in Hungary really tried to push this issue to the fore, even then, though, he was not talking per se about dissolving the political councils of the Warsaw Pact. He just wanted to get a clear commitment on the termination of the Warsaw Pact's military organizations. And so even then, Gorbachev had some reason to hope that the Warsaw Pact would survive as a political organization. Now, what changed that really was in January 1991, when there was a crackdown in Lithuania and Latvia, and many of the East European governments reacted to that harshly, including certainly the Polish government, which was then under new president Lech Wałęsa, because until December 1990, formally General Jaruzelski had been president. That crackdown in the Baltic states changed the attitudes of a lot of the East Europeans, and they began much stronger movement to push for the outright dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. And that culminated in late February 1991. This is after German unification has been achieved. So in the beginning of 1991, as a result of that crackdown, the East European governments now push much more strongly. And then I use East European as shorthand to talk about the other former members of the Warsaw Pact, not necessarily geographic or political. At the end of February 1991, the Hungarian government gets Gorbachev to agree to hold a meeting at the very end of June 1991 that will essentially dissolve the Warsaw Pact as an organization, including its political councils. So at that point, Gorbachev did understand what the fate of the Warsaw Pact was going to be. But there's no evidence because, again, I looked at all of the available transcripts of conversations held between East German leaders at that point and Soviet leaders, not just Gorbachev, but also with other Soviet officials, to see what was being said about the Warsaw Pact. And there's no evidence that at any point then the Warsaw Pact governments talked about the prospect of joining NATO. However, I should note that in February and March 1991, Václav Havel and Lech Wałęsa had gone to NATO headquarters in Brussels and alluded to this prospect. Havel did actually more than allude to it. He raised it quite explicitly about someday we might want to be brought under the auspices of NATO. So it was being talked about at that point, but there's no indication that an East European leader said to the Soviet Union, we will or will not join NATO in the future. That's as close as I can come to answering the question that you raised.
Andy Cutchins, CSIS. Mark, thanks so much for a really interesting article. I apologize for not being here earlier, but I was actually meeting with the Russian ambassador. I did try to convince him to come over here for lunch, but he was previously engaged. On this, Russians have been claiming this for years, and certainly before Putin even. And my response has always been to them, well, if you cared so much about this, then why didn't you get it in writing? Interestingly enough, Medvedev, when he met with the Valdai Discussion Club last September, for the first time I heard a Russian leader say, well, probably we should have gotten this in writing. We made a mistake. Certainly something that Mr. Putin never said. My question, though, is where in researching this, where did this originate from, this notion? There's clearly not any justification for this assertion on the basis of evidence or data, and I've never seen any either. Where did it come from? When did it first emerge, and why? I remember Mr. Yeltsin was in Poland, was it 1993, where he talked about the possibility of Russia joining NATO, which would seemingly be somewhat at odds with this pledge notion. And if you could talk a little bit about that, I'd be interested.
And whoops. A question that I have certainly thought about a good deal. Let me say that the reason on the first point that you raised, Andy, the question of getting it in writing, there is a reason that it was that Soviet leaders didn't get it in writing, which is simply that it wasn't an issue of concern to them at the time. That is evident in the negotiating record that Gorbachev was very concerned about the status of Eastern Germany. It comes up in the bilateral discussions a lot. Including in July 1990 when Gorbachev meets with Kohl in Stavropol and Moscow, but particularly before that in February 1990 when he holds bilateral discussions with Secretary of State Baker and then Helmut Kohl. And in those discussions, he makes clear that he's very uneasy about having Germany in NATO in February, and then in July he wants to ensure that there'll be a special military status of Germany. And he did get those in writing. That is, those are in Article 5 of the final settlement on Germany, the Treaty on the Final Settlement, and they were all spelled out as Gorbachev wanted them. So in that sense, Gorbachev wasn't, because the notion that he didn't get it in writing, as Medvedev raised it, implies that Gorbachev was incompetent. But the basic problem, or depending on how you look at it, the basic reason is that it wasn't an issue of concern at the time. So he did get in writing what was the issue of concern. Question, though, of where these claims came from, they weren't made at the time, oddly enough, including in 1991, when Havel and Walesa went to, particularly Havel, because Havel was quite explicit in his visit to NATO headquarters. This was well before the Soviet Union broke apart, but just after the events in the Baltic states. And I looked both at the declassified Soviet records and at the Soviet press at the time to see whether Soviet officials had raised this question about a pledge or a commitment or something that had been made about NATO in reaction to Havel's statement, and there wasn't anything there. It wasn't brought up in that context. As you say, as you rightly point out, too, when Yeltsin went to Moscow in August 1990, when Yeltsin went to Warsaw in August 1993, and Walesa raised this issue, it became a somewhat uncomfortable point then, but he too at that point didn't raise this question about a commitment that had been provided. When it seems to have originated was in late 1994 and then particularly in 1995 when the Clinton administration indicated that it had shifted its position on NATO enlargement and was now in favor of it. My guess is that the reason this notion had not been brought up earlier is that initially the U.S. government was opposed to NATO enlargement. When East European officials would raise it, as Havel did in early 1991, they were basically told that this was a non-starter and that it was pointless to try to pursue the issue. Initially, U.S. officials were concerned that it would undermine Gorbachev if it were raised, so they tried to deflect any consideration of it. This was during the Bush administration. And then in the first year and a half or so of the Clinton administration as well, the whole notion of NATO enlargement was dismissed and was essentially treated as a non-starter. So it wasn't until the spring or so of 1994 that the Clinton administration began to turn around on that, and then quite clearly in the summer of 1994. And it seems to have been in reaction to that turnaround that the first claims were made about it. I haven't yet been able to pinpoint who it was that made the first claim. It was not the earliest one that I've been able to find was not Andrei Kozyrev. I thought it was because he had raised this in the fall of 1995. But I subsequently found an earlier statement by Valentin Fallin. But it, again, this too was in 1995. So Fallin's statement is the earliest one that I've been able to find. It was a comment made at a meeting in Munich on security policy, and no one really followed up on it to try to find out what specifically he meant. So that's, as best I can tell, the first time it was actually put forth. Actually, I just checked my notes. July 1995.
Thanks, Mark. Excuse me. And again, congratulations on a great piece. Just a couple of things, just picking up on what you just said, though. I think actually by the end of the Bush administration, Bush 41, in 92, the acting Secretary of State Eagleburger at that time said, you know, we can no longer push this down the road. And he was partly reacting to the appeals that Havel was playing on this theme of a silver curtain that was emerging to replace the Iron Curtain. Valenza was talking about light at the end of the tunnel that was needed, you know, 91, 92 period. So he did finally succeed. And I was able to actually publish an article in the Washington Quarterly arguing that we couldn't kick it down the road in 91, so when I was serving in government. I wanted to pick you up on the Treaty of German Unity because I do think that's key to some of the Russian concerns and then maybe how it interacted with later discussions. And I wonder if you looked at that question, because there was implicit in the Treaty of German Unity some compromise of German sovereignty agreed to on a temporary basis to not have NATO forces or German, you know, German assigned NATO forces on the territory of the GDR. And it was concern over that period, that interregnum of when you still have a group of Soviet forces, Germany there, there was concern about some kind of an incident or something that could happen. But I wonder if you think that the Russians pocketed that or at least extrapolated from that, and then later as you get into this transition and once the Clinton administration did finally adopt its commitment, I remember there was a formulation that a number of people, including the Deputy Secretary of State and others, were using that, you know, there was no reason, no intent, it was a three-phrased point about, in other words, even if we do expand NATO, there'll be no reason to, in a sense, what the Russians were very worried about was having, Rhein-Main and the inner German border on the Polish-Russian border or the Polish-Belarusian border. And there was that sort of assurance that was being made. And I wondered if you looked at saw any of that record that the Russians were trying to link to, well, we had this commitment about Germany, and then also then these later statements that were saying that, well, you know, as long as Russia is not over-militarizing Central Europe again, if you can live up to all of your CFE commitments, pull the forces back into the Russian Federation proper, then there would be no reason for NATO to have this, you know, military buildup. Because there were some of those kinds of assurances that were out there. Again, nothing written, as you point out, but I wondered if you had seen any kind of interaction between those two streams of thought that might have led to this Russian extrapolation that, well, there was a real, you know, we had an assurance that, in a sense, what was practiced under the Treaty of German Unity would be followed on, you know, if there were any further, or that there would be no further movement of NATO eastward.
let me just say the status that Eastern Germany is accorded under the Treaty on Final Settlement with respect to Germany is not unique in any sense. There are quite a few NATO countries that qualify whether NATO troops can be deployed there at all or in what configuration, with nuclear weapons and the like. So in that sense, the qualification that is attached to Germany's membership in that treaty is in line with quite a few such provisions that have attended to NATO over the years. So the how the Soviet Union construed that, though, is very much in line with what Gorbachev and other Soviet officials were pushing for in 1990, and also what they were being promised. From Secretary of State Baker's talks on in February 1990 through the culminating talks in July 1990 with Kohl, this is pretty much what Gorbachev was being promised, is that there would be a special military status with respect to Eastern Germany. It doesn't affect Western Germany, what had been the Federal Republic of Germany, and it also, after Soviet forces were pulled out, it wasn't supposed to affect German forces assigned to NATO, so essentially NATO forces stationed in Eastern Germany. In that respect, the qualification with regard to Germany was considerably less far-reaching than qualifications that have been attached by other NATO members from time to time. The whether the Soviet Union, though, construed some of what had been promised under the treaty with respect to final settlement and other assurances that were given, that particularly about that NATO was changing, that's what the July 1990 London Declaration had proclaimed. The proclamation that was adopted at the London meeting of the heads of state of NATO did talk about changing from changing the nature of NATO to accord with the fundamental changes that had occurred in Eastern Europe. In my view, I remember at the time, but also in retrospect, I think that made perfect sense. That is, it would have been foolish to keep NATO in a Cold War configuration at a time when the whole security situation in Europe had fundamentally changed. But whether the interpretations of that, though, that were given to it were interesting. The Foreign Minister Shevardnadze alluded to the London Declaration at the Congress that was being held, the 28th Party Congress that was being held, and talked about it as signaling the transformation of NATO to an entirely new organization, essentially what Gorbachev had been pushing, the notion of the simultaneous transformation and probable dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and NATO. So I do think there was some unfounded optimism that NATO was somehow going to become a meaningless organization from that point on. And I do also sense a real degree of disappointment that NATO remained, again, not so much a military organization any longer, although it still has important military functions, but that it remains the central security institution in Europe. And there were East Europeans, too, who initially hoped that the CSCE and what became the OSCE would replace NATO and the Warsaw Pact as the predominant security institution in Europe. They abandoned that fairly early. And Soviet leaders, too, I think, realized that if NATO were going to be displaced as the predominant security institution in Europe, that it wasn't going to come from CSCE/OSCE. But I do sense a real degree of disappointment that NATO remained in Moscow. NATO remained the predominant security institution in Europe. However, that doesn't mean you can claim from that that you received a specific commitment or pledge or categorical assurance that NATO would disappear or that NATO would not be expanded. That's a different, somewhat narrower, but still important question, is whether these claims about such pledges and commitments are valid. And that's where I'm arguing that they are not valid. I do think that Russian officials do feel a sense of betrayal in a larger context in talking about the enlargement of NATO. I favored NATO enlargement, but I'm perfectly willing to concede that it did have drawbacks as well. No policy ever has, or very few policies usually have only benefits. You're always weighing benefits and drawbacks. So I'm quite willing to concede that in a larger context, Russian leaders probably did feel betrayed. But what I'm trying to focus on is this specific question of whether there was a concrete assurance or pledge or some other real guarantee that was provided. So that's how I'd answer.
And, Mark, what I was asking about was really kind of the period even 93, 94 into 95, whether you saw anything in those statements that the Russians seized on, because nobody, absolutely nobody, in either Bush or Clinton administration assured there'd be no NATO enlargement, and that was implicit in the – and even though the Russians were a mirror imaging and hoping that NATO could go the way of the Warsaw – or the way they hoped the Warsaw Pact could survive as a political organization, that NATO could do the same, and you'd have sort of two political bodies consulting. But on the issue of no remilitarization of Central Europe as they withdrew their forces from Eastern and Central Europe, did you see anything in there that the Russians could have seized? Well, I don't know if that record is available yet. As you said, some of it is, you know, because that would be into the, you know, middle of the Clinton administration. Yeah.
There definitely, and again, there were certain assurances provided with respect to the first round of NATO enlargement. These pertain to the wording was very carefully ironed out about the deployment of large-scale military, the permanent deployment of large-scale military forces, that NATO has no current, the precise wording, I would... NATO has no current intent to deploy large-scale military forces on a permanent basis in the new NATO countries. That was very carefully worded out. And so far, I would say, again, you could raise questions about the proposed deployment of ballistic missile defense components in Poland and the Czech Republic. But leaving that aside, by and large, NATO has stuck with that. I don't think it's so much about that that Russian officials are raising questions. I honestly think because again, to go back to what Andy asked about, is these claims began to arise in 1995, 96. So it was really before that language was around. And part of the reason for that language was that Russian officials were seeking to prevent the remilitarization of NATO and so forth. But the basic problem from their view, I think, is that NATO, a U.S.-led organization, remains the predominant security institution in Europe. And they, even when it is talked about that Russia could someday join NATO, they definitely sense that that will never be an organization that they will want to join or be able to join. So that's where I think the real sense comes from, rather than about anything concrete that happened even in 1993 to
95. Mark, let me continue to shift the discussion a little bit from the history to the contemporary application. Can you talk and elaborate a little bit more about the significance of this claim today? You talked... Obviously, in NATO enlargement itself, it plays into the Ukraine and Georgia debates. You mentioned during your remarks the potential application for the ballistic missile defense assets. You talked in the article a little bit about claims that it may have played a role in the Georgia conflict last August. But can you elaborate a little bit on each of those areas and others and how important this claim is today?
Unfortunately, it is important today. It shouldn't be, but it is. And... that's, you know, in many respects, I'm writing here an article about history. But the The depressing reality of it, though, is that this is an article also about current policy, about current U.S.-Russian relations, about current NATO-Russian relations. And so long as there are claims being made by Russian officials that NATO enlargement was invalid because it violated an assurance or a pledge or a commitment that was made in 1990, then there will be opposition raised, or at least questions raised about the desirability of further NATO enlargement. Now, again, I'm not talking here about whether that is desirable. There is ample room to debate whether bringing Albania into NATO was desirable, about whether bringing Georgia and Ukraine would be desirable and the like. So I'm not dealing with that question per se. The question I'm looking at is whether opposition to that idea, or whether Russia's efforts to oppose it are well-founded because of claims of a violation of a pledge or an assurance or some sort of guarantee that was provided. So what I'm arguing is that on those grounds, the opposition simply doesn't hold up. And again, I cited this speech by Putin last year, in October of last year. I cited in the article very recent statements by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. I know he has repeated these in the presence of some people in the room quite recently. I know that Lavrov also in March, I believe, of this year again, where he was giving a speech talking about security concerns in Europe, raised this even more directly than the comment that I cite here. So this is very much an issue of current public policy and will be so long as these claims go unchallenged. That's what, again, it wasn't the major reason I wrote this article. I wrote it because I was interested in this question. I like to look at particular issues on the basis of evidence that's now finally available, because when this issue was raised in 1995-96, there really was no way to assess it beyond the say-so of certain people at the time. What's changed over the last few years, really since the end of 2006, is that you actually can now go through the records. The records are available from all sides, and you can look at them, compare them, try to weigh them against interviews with former officials. And that's why now I am fully convinced that there was no such pledge or commitment or guarantee offered for a very simple reason. It wasn't an issue of concern to Gorbachev or other Soviet leaders at the time. They were thinking their major concern was the whole question of Germany and how it would be treated. And as I say, even when after German unification was completed, even in early 1991, when Havel raised quite explicitly this question at NATO headquarters and was basically brushed off at that point. But when he raised it, Soviet leaders even then did not really respond to it, did not regard it as a likely prospect. They were reassured when NATO brushed it off. So it's understandable that there weren't such assurances or commitments made. Today, though, in looking back and having these false claims or disingenuous claims, I have to assume that in Putin's case it's disingenuous, because the way he changed, or the way his aides, speechwriters, changed the quotation makes it into something fundamentally different from what it actually was. And so long as these go unchallenged, there will be opposition raised against what should be done with NATO on invalid grounds. If there is going to be a debate about further NATO enlargement, it should be about valid issues, not about spurious ones.
Bernazzi, on the record, ever support what Putin has said?
Shevardnadze hasn't really, being in Tbilisi now, hasn't really commented. I've been unable to interview him about it, unfortunately. I did interview Gorbachev, although it wasn't that useful an interview. He was at Cambridge. He was in Cambridge in November 2002. And I did ask him about this at that point. But what I found far more illuminating was Poroshenko was with him on that trip. And I did ask him about that. I don't know, though, about his specific reaction to Putin's speech. Again, Putin gave this speech in October of last year. And I am actually going to be at a conference with Gorbachev, or I hope he'll be able to make it later this year. So I do definitely intend to ask him about it then. But as I say, because Putin misquoted deliberately or maybe innocently misquoted Werner's comments. but in this case, I assume it was his speech. Well, maybe not. But in any event, though, Shevardnadze, though, is much harder. It's generally his efforts to write memoirs have been very unilluminating. He put out a memoir that's come out in German, which I read, and it's really quite vacuous, unfortunately. He doesn't get to any of the concrete substance of this, and I haven't been able to interview him about it. But He played some role on this issue, but was definitely not as important as Gorbachev himself. Chernyayev played an important role in it. I should add, Shevardnadze was opposed to having, much more strongly opposed, ultimately, than Gorbachev was to having a united Germany in NATO. The reason being, probably valid from his standpoint, was he feared that the hardline forces in the Soviet Union, and of course, Shevardnadze was in Yakovlev, Alexander Yakovlev, were coming under a fierce attack at that point. And so it's understandable that he would have feared this, but he thought that it would give hardline forces in Moscow grounds for basically trying to get rid of Shevardnadze and trying to get rid of Yakovlev, and essentially moving the Soviet Union in a more aggressive direction. And that's why when Shevardnadze abruptly resigned in December 1990, he did raise this issue about Germany and so forth. He said that these hardline forces that he alluded to in that speech were using that issue against him. So his memoranda on this issue were, Shevardnadze's own memoranda were quite hardline on this point. And my guess is that if there were such an assurance that had been provided to him, he certainly would be emphasizing it. He never made such a claim, though. And He's, you know, if you look at the officials, the former officials who have made it, it's people like Fallin, Gorbachev, others who did play important roles in it, but who also, well, Fallin was probably the most dogmatic against it, but who ultimately were willing to go along with the united Germany and NATO, whereas Shevardnadze really remained quite opposed to it, even after Gorbachev had decided to go along with it.
Mark, can I press you a little bit? Just what did Gorbachev say to you in 2002 when he was asked this question? Do you remember?
Oh, okay. He had to, because, again, I tried to I didn't yet have the Soviet records at that point. He claimed that in the Soviet records there was evidence of such an assurance. So I didn't at that point have any way of countering him because the records hadn't been declassified yet. As I say, I welcome the opportunity to question him about it now, and I have, since looking at these records, have been able to speak to Poroshenko and Chernyayev, and both of them say, because Chernyayev in particular has gone through all these records himself. He's quite elderly now. He's about 88 now, I think, and not in great health, but is very mentally alert and has really been really been played an admirable role in pushing for the release of a lot of these documents. He's had to overcome the opposition of Gorbachev to releasing quite a few of them. So Chernyayev, his judgment on it, I particularly respected. And as I say, he said that he hasn't been able to find any such assurance or commitment. Now, in Palashchenko, the same. Palashchenko, again, was present at all the discussions with U.S. leaders, including discussions that might have been off the record. But both Palashchenko in particular told me there wasn't any further discussion of such issues off the record, which was an important thing to pin down. So in that sense, I think I would have to wait to say that if I do get the opportunity in late 2009 to interview Gorbachev on this again, I will say, well, I have now done what you said in November 2002 and gone through all the records and haven't found it. So.
Keith, thanks for being patient.
Keith Smith, CSIS. And maybe Steve would know a little bit more than I do about this, but I remember spending a lot of time in the Baltic states starting in late 92 and 93. And by 94, I was spending a lot of time there. And we had, early on, the U.S. sent military training teams there. We called them contact teams, but they were doing training. Then they were also another kind of team, which actually was called training teams, the TTs. I remember discussions with Russian ambassadors at the time, and I don't remember any of them in this would be mainly Latvia and Estonia, who complained about these American units there doing training and connected them to any kind of commitment by the United States government. Steve, I don't remember any of this, and I never heard of this later on when I was there back in 95 and then in 97 to 2000, any of this.
No, I agree. They started out with something called the Kievenauer Assessments, which was General Buzz Kievenauer, who now works at SAIC, was... He was asked to go out and do assessments of all of the prospective members of NATO, and then the Balts finally came on the net and asked for assessments as well, and I think that was finally agreed. But that was probably around 95.
Well, but before then, there were
the other teams were earlier. That's true, but
similarly,
the contact
units
were there. We had people permanently in the Baltic states,
and they were advising
semi-permanently,
right? And we had U.S. nationals, as you know,
certainly by 94.
Yeah, it was in connection with the Partnership for Peace, which had been set up at the beginning of 1994. It was at that same time that it wasn't actually even so much the United States. It was more Sweden and one other Scandinavian country, Norway, I think, began setting up different forms of cooperation with all of the Baltic governments to basically to integrate them more closely into Western security structure.
Well, we had the largest group, and then the British generally were right behind us. So it was the U.S. and the British with some support from the Swedes, the Danes, but it was mainly the U.S. We had the largest, and the Brits were doing training on non-commissioned officers generally. But anyway, it was kind of interesting because I didn't hear any complaints from the Russian ambassadors.
Yeah, I mean, the Baltic states were somewhat different. Andrei Kozarev, who was the first Russian foreign minister, made very harsh statements about the Baltic states quite early on in 1993, even late 92, but particularly 1993. But he never raised the question about whether they would be integrated into NATO. As I say, the first direct statement about that, about an assurance that had supposedly been provided, wasn't until July 1995, because I've looked in every available, fortunately, Eastview Press has done a compilation of Russian press and Russian journals and then also the Russian Foreign Ministry publications and the like. And so I've been able to go through all of those going back to 1993 and haven't found anything about such a supposed pledge until July 1995. Also was that the there were senior U.S. officials. It seems to have been particularly U.S. officials, the comments by U.S. officials that Russian leaders were more concerned about, but that began really pushing the prospect of NATO enlargement, because it initially there was quite a bit of skepticism about it, especially in some NATO capitals, about whether it should proceed at all, and if it did proceed, on what timetable and how many new members and the like. So that's it. Really, the comments that Fallin made were in reaction to he didn't actually cite, as I look at what he said, he didn't cite a specific statement, but he said there has been discussion of extending NATO to former members of the Warsaw Pact. That's all he says. He doesn't cite the specific comment, but it was U.S. officials at that point who began talking about it. Well, they had begun talking about it earlier, but there were some publicly reported comments that I suspect prompted his comment.
But, and you said that they never anticipated partnership to go so quickly.
Yes.
It was a kind of stopgap that they used that many people in the military. And as I recall, the member was ill with cancer, and that this was something that he didn't want the partnership to continue to march on, and that sort of closed that.
Yeah. Well, the yeah. No, initially, a lot of the East European governments construed the PFP as an effort to get them to forget about joining NATO, that it was a substitute for that. And they were actually somewhat dismayed by it. I mean, they joined it and so forth and participated in it, but they were actually put off by it. And, I mean, especially, I would say, in my visits to the different East European capitals at that point, especially in Warsaw, in Prague, and to a lesser degree in Budapest, but saw the PFP initially as just a way of trying to get them to forget about NATO enlargement. But so the Russian reaction to PFP initially, I think, was less harsh than it might have been had there not been that kind of reaction in Eastern Europe. If the East Europeans had said, yes, let's join so we can also join NATO soon as well, I suspect you would have had those expressions of concern earlier.
Just on the timing, Mark, and Elizabeth, I think, is right. I mean, first of all, Werner was out there very outspoken in advocating enlargement, but by 95, yeah. You finally had the decision, yeah, of the U.S. government to go ahead and have the study on NATO enlargement. So the U.S. government was still divided at the, yeah, time, and especially DOD was, yeah, very much, you know, yeah, let's keep PFP going and, yeah, push off the enlargement issue for fear of angering the Russians.
Yes.
But eventually that was decided, and NATO was in the middle of the study.
Right.
So that's probably part of what
that's
the Russians,
right,
were reacting to. They knew this was now a train that was building some momentum.
That's right. And that study was published, yeah, in September 1995. But there had been public, yeah, comments about it even earlier, and that's what I think probably sparked
decision in the, I think it was a, right, Brussels summit in early 95 that,
right,
said we would do this.
Right,
so
right,
that was.
But then there were more explicit comments about it, though, I think in June and July, you know, that began to point to what direction it would take. And it was pretty much a long, when it came out in September 1995, it was pretty much along the lines that people had been talking about in the summer. I should note that in addition to Werner's role, the German defense minister, Volker Ruhe, had been making a lot of comments very strongly in favor of NATO enlargement, going back to early 1994. So shortly after PFP took shape, he was very explicit about what he saw its purpose as being. But as I say, the U.S. government, the Clinton administration, was not yet signed up to that at that point. But his comments, when you look back on them now, were so strong that it would have been hard for the German government to back down after what he said. Unfortunately, I do think his comments, though, also because they were quite explicit in saying that NATO enlargement is directed against Russia. So I think it gave it an unfortunate color that it shouldn't have had. And that's why I say that NATO enlargement took a toll on NATO-Russian relations that I think could have been avoided. And part of it was the comments he was making. If you look back at those now, he said that NATO can encompass all of Europe and ideally someday will. But Russia is not part of Europe and never will be. And so I think had he not, by the way, those comments were reacted to in Moscow. But people, what's that? The German defense minister, Volker Rühe, who this was in 1994, even before it was clear that the Clinton administration would change. So as I say, in that sense, I think that NATO enlargement could have been pursued in a more inclusive way that wouldn't have had as serious costs with relations with Russia as it ultimately did. But that's a quite different issue.
With that, I'm going to bring this session to a close. For those of you that didn't pick it up on your way in, a copy of Mark's article and the entire April issue are available outside. This also corresponds with the release of the July issue today online. Those of you who are sitting at the table have the table of contents for that new issue. The hard copy will be sent out to subscribers in bookstores in about a week or two. I want to thank three people in particular. One is Celeste Wallander in her former life, had a role not just in encouraging Mark to write the article in the first place, but as a member of the editorial board of the Quarterly at the time, told me to take a look at it seriously when Mark sent it in, and that helped get both of us to pay our attention to it. We might otherwise have been looking at other things. And so I want to thank her particularly in that role before as the editorial board. The second is Sahar Khan, the associate editor, and Kevin, who does everything else in our office this summer, are responsible for pulling this thing together. So on your way out, if you can thank them for that. And finally, please help me in thanking Mark, especially for taking the time out during his trip to come in and share his ideas and his research with us. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.